It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. When you look around the world right now, how hopeful do you feel?
When I first got a job, it was teaching at Yale Divinity School. And that required doing some travel to do research and also talks.
This is Andre Willis. He's a philosopher of religion at Brown University.
And what I began to see was suffering and despair were sort of much more noticeable than they had been.
I lost my job. It happens. It happens to the best of us, unfortunately.
I felt like the U.S. and even globally when I did foreign travel had levels of suffering and psychic challenges that felt like they needed real help.
Live in hope. You know, everybody deserves a second chance. You know, sometimes 3, 4, or 5 second chances. Yeah. And, you know, it's not easy.
Homeless people in San Francisco and L.A., finding people under tents in bike trails in Austin, New York panhandlers.
I have holes in my tent, but I'm not worried about that. God has me. He supplied a way for me to wash some of my clothes, what I really needed to get wet and dry. He gave me time enough.
Like, here I am in need, vulnerably asking you to donate some change to me, but I recognize that it's not going to do much for me.
The social worker system doesn't work. There's too many of us out here.
At the same time, there's a real push to dumb down hope.
I want to talk to you today about staying full of hope.
Advertisements, popular sermons, figures like Joel Osteen.
But you need to hear these words. The tide is coming back.
Even Oprah features this book, The Secret, on her program.
You are responsible for your life.
This American idea that if I just believe it.
If you're sitting around waiting on somebody to save you.
If I hope for it enough.
To fix you, to even help you.
I can shape my destiny. I can attain it.
You are wasting your time.
I reject that approach to hope. I say we think about it differently.
Hope means the ability to still
our
be
best
here,
futures
fighting.
Hope
don't
right there in your face.
Hope,
at the moment.
Optimism, happiness.
Hope,
work.
Hope is essential.
Hope rises. She always does.
Welcome to Hope, a 3-part series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. Episode 1, where does it come from? How does hope rise? In dark times and uncertain futures, what sparks hope?
Hope is connected to faith.
Of what use is love if the situation is hopeless?
Let's do hope.
So this is maybe an odd way to begin, but when our producers said they wanted to do a series on hope, I thought, seriously? 3 hours on a topic that sounds like a Hallmark card? I mean, hope just felt so bland, trite, dumb. But then I talked with Andre Willis, a philosopher of religion, and he agreed.
I think that is the case. Like, people are getting sick and tired of hope speech because they hear it so much. We're becoming saturated with this keep hope alive, you know. There's hope even if you're hopeless, right? This is a moment to hope against the odds. But it's become so superficial that it's meaningless.
Andre thinks there are actually 2 kinds of hope, deep hope and shallow hope. Shallow is the familiar kind, you know. I hope my career is successful. My kids do well in school. I hope my pizza comes soon. But we're forgetting the deep hope. Andre says it's harder to find. Wow, you're describing this paradox where we're talking more and more about hope and feeling less and less of it.
Well, yeah, we're feeling less and less of the kind of deep hope that I'm after, but maybe we're being more and more compelled by this idea that hope is just a kind of belief, and if you have enough of it, you can attain this future object. So I think it might work for some. At least it can work for some time. But there's always this confrontation with the tragic, that is, this facing of the ultimate. Attending to someone with, say, a degenerative disease like Alzheimer's, or to be close to communities that go downhill. That language of hope is unsatisfying in those situations because there's no way out. Things do not get better. Watching folks in those situations has taught me that it's a deeper relation to the present is the kind of hope I might be happy with thinking about. And that's what I call the deep hope.
Can you help me understand that more? For instance, you described some situations caring for somebody with Alzheimer's or somebody with another degenerative disease. Have you had that experience yourself?
Well, no, I've come close to a lot of folks who are dying in my service as a family member and as a minister. Mm-hmm. I used to be a minister in a Baptist church. So I've been around death, buried folks and married folks. What I learned from those experiences is that deep hope might be as simple as forms of togetherness. That is, people and communities still come together. Whether they can improve the situation or not is not the question. It's the togetherness itself, which I want to think about as a form of hope that is sustaining. It's not future-directed and future-oriented. Is not engaged with a kind of probability question about what's coming later, but it's fully present.
What does that feel like, look like? It sounds like you're talking about people coming together at a time of despair, knowing that things are not going to get better. What does hope mean in that situation?
We turn to Martin Luther King as a way of answering that question, but it's not the Martin Luther King who's been commodified in the I Have a Dream speech of 1963 is actually another sermon that Martin gave called Unfulfilled Dreams, where he talked about all of our hopes being always blasted and our dreams persistently shattered.
That is not the Martin Luther King Jr. I know of.
Exactly. And he gave this sermon, Unfulfilled Dreams, more than one time. He also gave it a month before he was murdered. And what Martin described in that sermon was that his dreams were not going to come true, that his project ultimately was going to fail, and it had fallen short, but that he knew he was not to be judged by what his hopes were and how they were not reached, but the quality and depth of commitment to his community in his own heart. So that's what I think about as a kind of deep hope.
I'm still trying to imagine a hope that isn't about a goal and maybe even isn't about the future. I mean, what does it feel like to you to say, yes, I have hope?
I think it's less a redefining of hope than it is what comes from witnessing what people do when they're really facing odds that are insurmountable. They tend to, when they're at their best, right, let go of, at some point, I guess we all will let go of some kind of future aspirations, but we'll simply become more present and more in touch with the beauty and the simplicity of life as it's unfolding in front of us. So Rachel Naomi Remen talks about this. She works with survivors of cancer, people who are living with cancer. And she talks about a terminally ill patient who is able to go home to die and sees a full bottle of dishwashing liquid on the sink. And she sees it in such a new way that it evokes a sense of overall beauty and a fundamental unity of all. And so Rachel Naomi Remen's question is, why does it take such overwhelmingly dire circumstances to get to that kind of foundational understanding? And here's where I come in. I say it can redirect us away from the kind of commercialized, commodified, and frivolous superficial forms of hope that we're often captivated by.
But Andre, I have to say, I mean, I'm hardly alone. I look around the world, I read the newspapers, and you talked about the people you see on the street with such unhappiness. I think about climate change. I think about my children and whether they're going to have much of a future. And I think of all those people massed at the border, desperate to get somewhere. I'm scared about the future, and things look bad.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that kind of hits the nail on the head for me. I mean, the problem for me with the grammar of hope is that it doesn't attend to the catastrophes that we're facing. So if we were to say that there's actually hope for the planet, given what we know, we're telling ourselves a lie. The best thing we can do, I think, is to prepare for what's coming. And that's the kind of deep hope I'm after, which is to say that we don't need a romantic story about how we can overcome this problem. The problem's not going to go away. We can do better to confront it, but we're not going to solve it. How do you live with that? That's the kind of deep hope I'm calling for. Be present to it, be together with others in it, and face it honestly. And that's a form of hope that we don't see a lot in our culture.
Yeah. I think you find that especially in the African-American tradition. Is that why that tradition of deep hope comes to us from people who have been rendered hopeless?
Well, certainly. I think that this is what the complicated gift of suffering can do. When folks have faced insurmountable odds for generations, we look at what they've done. Something like the blues, a form which in itself isn't future-oriented or directed toward probable aim, but celebrates a way of being together in the face of what is. And we see this in other forms of suffering, too. I mean, I'm reminded of certain descriptions of Jews in concentration camps, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's a whole lot of togetherness, some singing, some, hey, we're not going to get out of here, but the best we can do is to attend to what is face to face with this despair and grief.
You know, I'm thinking about the days after 9/11, there was so much tragedy, so much grief. And at the same time, what so many people have said is that that was a really wonderful period of time because people came together. There was this sense of collective, shared kindness.
Well, what I like about that point is that there's another approach that also is useful, which is simply to be a hope. And I think post 9/11 was a context when people knew that they had to act, and they had to act in ways that were useful for themselves and their neighbors. So therefore, one is the hope of the neighborhood, the hope of their community, the hope that helps us get through these odds, not overcomes them, but helps us deal with them.
Andre Willis is a professor of religious studies at Brown University. He writes about the Enlightenment, hope, and African-American religion. So here's a scary idea. What if the secret to feeling more hope is not philosophy, but neuroscience? And what if someday a doctor can hook you up to a nifty device and say, look, here's your brain on hope? It's not as far-fetched as you'd think.
They put a little
electrode through the scalp, and they target an area in the brain called the rostral anterior cingulate cortex that is in your frontal part of your brain. And by doing that, by triggering electricity to that part of the brain, there's an immediate reaction in patients, immediately, like that exact second. Suddenly, they describe it as a feeling of warmth and hope. I think one patient said something like, it's a feeling of spring. They've been, you know, it's all dark. And then the moment that little electrode is turned on, it's simulating the neurons in that part of the brain. There is a feeling of hope and optimism. So it already exists.
Sounds good to me. Stick around. More hope is on the way. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. NPRX. We started this hour talking about how hard it can be to hold on to hope, especially today when there's so much to worry about. But you know, maybe we don't have to work so hard at it, because it turns out we are hardwired for hope and optimism from birth. Tali Sharat is the neuroscientist who's best known for discovering our brain's optimism bias. And she started out looking at the brain system we use to store memories. And then she discovered that we use the very same system to imagine the future, which we do a lot of. So Tali tried asking people to imagine bad, terrible futures. She told Steve Paulson it did not go the way she thought at all.
When I started my experiment, something unexpected happened, which is people kept taking the events that I was telling them to imagine, and they were turning them to something positive. So for example, I would say, imagine the breakup of a relationship. And someone said, I broke up with my girlfriend, and then I found a better one. So this was quite upsetting because it ruined my experiment.
Although you might have drawn some comfort from the way these people were responding.
Because I was going to see what happens in the brain when you imagine these negative events, but people were reluctant to imagine them, so that was no good. And at the end, I thought, well, actually, this is perhaps more interesting than what I started out investigating. And I looked into the literature about this thing called the optimism bias, which is a tendency of people to imagine the future as being better than the past and the present. It wasn't known where this is coming from, what's underlying it, what are the cognitive or neural mechanisms that generate this optimism bias. And that's how I started trying to figure out where it's coming from. How is it happening?
So how is it happening?
Well, one key insight that we had from our research is that people tend to learn less from negative information, unexpected negative information, than unexpected positive information. So for example, if I tell you you're less likely to have cancer than you thought, so I give you positive news, you're more likely to take that positive information in and change your beliefs. But if I tell you you are more likely to have cancer than you thought, so this is bad news, you're less likely to listen. And when we looked in the brain, what we could see is that parts of our frontal lobe, in the front of our brain, we could look at the activity there and we could see that there was not as precise and good, I would say, encoding of this negative information versus positive information.
Are you saying the brain is hardwired to be hopeful?
Well, whether it's hardwired is a tricky question. On the one hand, we believe that humans, yes, have evolved to be optimistic. The reason that we believe that is that we see optimism bias in different individuals, in different cultures, and also in non-human animals. There are quite sophisticated designs and paradigms to look at different kind of species, from bees to even pigs and birds, and show that actually they have optimism and positive expectations. So that all suggests that it's something that we have evolved to be, that it's not dependent on a culture. So that would suggest something that you call hardwired. But what we found recently is that, in fact, it's even better than that. So it's not that people are always optimistically or optimistically biased, but it depends on the context. So in fact, if you put them in dangerous situations and you put them under stress, they suddenly become hypervigilant to the negative and they no longer have an optimism bias. And this can happen within minutes or within seconds.
You can see this in evolutionary terms. If our ancestors were out on the savannah and a lion approached them, you know, you want to have that stressful reaction. You want to see danger.
Exactly. And so the brain has this little trick. It changes its optimism bias. Why is that a good thing? Well, if you think about it, the consequence of having an optimism bias, and we haven't even defined what an optimism bias is.
Right.
So an optimism bias is the tendency to overestimate the likelihood of positive events happening in your life, such as professional success or having talented kids or having a happy marriage, and underestimating the likelihood of negative events, such as divorce, cancer, accidents. And so you can think, well, why do we have the optimism bias? Is it good for us? Is it bad for us? If you do have these positive expectations, well, that actually is related to better mental health. Anxiety is reduced. That's good. It's also related to better physical health. Turns out that people who have positive expectations live longer and get over illnesses quicker. Again, because you have less stress, that's good for your physical health, but also because people think, I'm going to do okay because I'm going to make it okay.
It's much easier to go out and chase after goals if you believe you can meet those goals rather than if you think, oh, I'm never going to be able to do that.
Absolutely. If I wake up in the morning and I say, well, my projects are not going to work out, you know, then I just stay in bed and I don't try, right? So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because it determines our actions. But on the negative side, you can say, well, I mean, if you underestimate negative events, you're underestimating risk. This is no good, right? You might not go to medical screenings when you need to. You might not buy insurance. You might not take precaution. So some people say that the 2008 financial collapse is related to an optimism bias where people were underestimating the dangers of the financial market, and that led to the collapse. So these are the dangers.
Now, you're using the word optimism. Does that mean the same thing as hope to you?
Not quite. So hope is what you want to happen. Optimism is the belief that what you want to happen will happen. And the optimism bias is the error that we make, is believing that it's more likely the things that we hope for are more likely than they actually end up being.
Now, you say that 80% of people are naturally optimistic, which I have to say is a huge number.
Yeah, so that number comes up again and again and again. Every experiment, every survey, any way you look at it, it's always 80-something percent. The studies show that most of us are mildly optimistic. But this mild optimism, on average, is not a bad thing. Optimists tend to also be happier. One thing that really affects our happiness is not necessarily what we're doing in the moment, but what we believe will happen in the future. So if I think this weekend I have plans for a great ski outing or something, well, that will affect my happiness today.
You're basically suggesting it's probably good for us to be slightly deluded about the
Absolutely.
Way things really work.
Absolutely. We find that people that do not have optimism bias, for example, which is an illusion, are ones that are likely to be depressed. So people with mild depression have no bias. That means that sometimes they err on the optimism side, sometimes they err on the pessimism side. On average, they don't have a systematic bias. But those with severe depression have a pessimistic bias. That means that they tend to expect the future to be worse than it ends up being.
I've heard some psychologists talk about a set point of happiness, that people basically have a limited range in how much they can actually change their natural tendency to be happy. And I'm wondering if that's also true for optimism? Or, you know, if you want to be more optimistic, can you actually kind of boost that level that you have?
Mm-hmm. It's very difficult, but some scientists suggest that it is possible. So, for example, Martin Seligman has studies where he actively tries to boost optimism in individuals who are not optimistic. These are normally people who have some form of depression. His training is mostly about how you interpret events. So optimists tend to interpret positive events as related to them personally. So for example, if you're an engineer and you did a project at work and it worked really well, the optimists tend to say, oh, this worked well because I'm really good at math. I'm a really good engineer. And not only that, I'm probably just intelligent in general. And so that means that I'll be good not only in these specific projects, but they generalize it to many other things in life. And that means that other things in life in the future will, you know, turn out well. And when they fail, they tend to interpret the failure as not related to themselves, as temporary, and not generalize it. So if the project failed, it's more about, well, I just happened to not put enough effort this time, or, oh, my competitor just happened to do better. It's not about me being stupid, and it definitely doesn't generalize to other parts of my life, and it therefore would not affect what I would expect in the future. So this is kind of the optimist way of thinking. And so what Martin Seligman does, he tries to train individuals to think in this kind of way.
So you've said that optimism and hope are not exactly the same thing, but let me pose the related question then, mm-hmm. Do you think you can teach hope?
So can you cause someone to hope for something? I think it's related to the question of motivation. So hoping, you have to hope for something, right? And what can happen in mental illness, for example, is that people don't have anything that they hope for because they don't care anymore. There's no motivation. But, you know, that's what certain psychotherapy is about, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, both hope and optimism are difficult. It's difficult to change. It's not impossible. People have shown that you could do it with certain amount of training and certain talk therapies and so on.
Given this particular historical moment that we're living in, where there is so much political uncertainty and, you know, climate change, a lot of people are feeling despair right now. And I guess I'm wondering if a neuroscientist's perspective can sort of help us think through the despair that so many people feel at this moment.
Well, I mean, neuroscience is only part of it. What we study is the human brain, cognition, the human mind. And one thing that has been known for quite a while is that there is a great distinction between public and private. So we have what we call private optimism, which is what we've talked about so far, but at the same time, we have public despair. So we've talked about how people are optimistic about their own life and their health and their marriage and so on. But at the same time, what we find is that people do not actually exhibit optimism about public affairs at all. So you would not see people saying that they're optimistic about their country, the future of their leaders, or even global warming. The question then becomes, why are we so optimistic about our own lives and the lives of our kids and our family, but not optimistic about these global affairs? There's a couple of answers, but one big one is that we tend to believe we have control over our own life, that we can steer the wheel in the right direction, right? And so therefore, we can make it that our life will become better. But we don't feel we have control over these big issues of politics and so on. And so we are not necessarily optimistic about those at all.
Tali Sherrod is the director of the Affective Brain Lab and a professor of cognitive neuroscience at University College in London. She's also the author of The Optimism Bias, Why We're Wired to Look on the Bright Side. And that was Steve Paulson talking with her. I was in Northern California recently in an area that's been decimated by forest fires. It's on the coast near Point Reyes, a spot that is literally on top of the San Andreas Fault. And I was there for a Geography of Hope conference. I met Claire Peasley there. She's a naturalist and I asked her where she finds hope.
Hope. I've thought about that question quite a lot because hope can be viewed as a delusion or a false medicine, a way of not looking at how things really are, because I'm in a delicate balancing act between excitement and hope and thrill for where we are right now and deep, bleak despair. So I actually went out into the Point Reyes National Seashore on a solo hike. I guess it was in January, late January, to walk with attention to the finest possible detail in the living world around us and let our minds relax, become rhythmic with a landscape. Now we're breathing. Now we're in the light. Now we're in the shade. Our feet are wet or not. Becoming a body again, becoming an animal. Feeling your bones, feeling your pelvis, holding you up and your shoulder blades dropping so your lungs open. And the pace, the walking pace, the reason why we evolved as an animal species, because we came down out of the trees and started walking on two legs, swinging our arms, eyes straight ahead. What am I supposed to know here? What is there here for me to learn? Gradually and repeatedly, an answer just arose. This simple. There are no secrets here. Just put one step in front of the other. Just put one foot in front of the other. We have another kind of intelligence. It comes from the more than human world. The sprouts of new twigs on a willow, or the unfurling of a fern, or insect life. Little hirsute thistles glowing in the sunlight, or a wren-tit's song. We're sensing things that are way, way, way down in the earth beneath us, and energies that are in the atmosphere overhead. And if we can drop our identities for long enough to enter into that continuum, we know lots of things. We certainly know how to take care of this planet and one another. We're meant to be joyous. And hope is joy for the future. There's no secret here. You just put one foot in front of the other.
Claire Peasley is a naturalist who lives near Point Reyes, California. And a special shout out to the Black Mountain Circle community and their Geography of Hope events.
I was excited to hear your program because I think hope is so important. I'm a grandparent. We as grandparents, if we don't have hope, what kind of gift are we giving our grandchildren?
I've seen the people that have the most hope tend to have belief in a higher power in their life.
The times that I've been hopeless were the times when my mother passed away, and then the hope comes in everyday life.
I lecture my friends about it when they get so down about the world, because that's the best gift we can give to the future, is to have hope for it and maintain hope.
What about you? Do you have thoughts about hope?
you can share them with us. We made it really easy to record your voice. Just go to our website at ttbook.org/hope. Share your thoughts and they just may wind up on the air. Coming up, poet Alice Walker on Hope, and why some of the most hopeful, optimistic people on the planet live in Nigeria. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. This hour, we're asking the question, where does hope come from? It's the first episode of a 3-hour series on hope from To the Best of Our Knowledge.
This is really trouble and downfall for all of humanity. Trump versus Putin, China, Russia, missiles, bombs,
My name is Steven Pinker. I'm the author of Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. And my dangerous idea is that today is the best time to be alive in all of human history. We live longer for most of human history. People could be expected to live no longer than 30 on average. Today, in the developed world, life expectancy is greater than 80, and in the world as a whole, greater than 70.
Our life expectancy has gone down.
We are better educated. For most of human history, most people were illiterate.
So far behind in their education.
Now, 80% of the world is literate, and 90% of the world under the age of 90.
They have no hope to recover.
We have decimated the horsemen of the apocalypse.
Fighting a virus that has no cure.
Disease is down, famine is down, war is down.
America versus Russia.
Crime is down.
Another mass shooting in America.
We enjoy more small pleasures. We can sample Thai food or Mexican food or Vietnamese food even in small American towns. We can access the world's culture and knowledge in a device that fits into a shirt pocket.
Our smartphones are making us stupid.
If I want to see Casablanca, I don't have to wait years for it to show up in a repertory theater, but stream it on demand.
Intellectual property theft.
In area after area, life is much better, despite the fact that if you consume news, you might get the opposite impression.
The level of faith in news media has tumbled to a new low.
The reason I call this a dangerous idea is that so many of our literary intellectuals, our cultural critics, believe and have believed for 150 years that Western civilization is spiraling downward, circling the drain, and will soon collapse of its own decadence. This seems to be a surprisingly popular position among many intellectuals who often see their role as disparaging all the institutions of modernity. Since the benefits that we have enjoyed haven't come out of magic, we have to attribute them to institutions like a liberal democracy, like markets that have made us richer and more cooperative, to organizations of international cooperation like the United Nations, which for all of its ridiculous theater has played a role in reducing the number of wars. Even though there's something corny and square and unhip about crediting our institutions, I think they do deserve the credit for the fantastic progress that we have enjoyed.
Steven Pinker is a professor of psychology at Harvard. He's the author of Enlightenment Now,
the case for reason, science, humanism, and progress. So he makes a strong case that the world is getting better and better. But look around you. Do people seem happier? I guess it depends on where you live. For years now, international polls have ranked Nigeria as one of the most optimistic nations in the world. The U.S., not so much. In fact, American optimism has been steadily dropping, which is odd, don't you think? Nigeria has rampant corruption, Boko Haram, poverty, an HIV/AIDS crisis, and America has everything. Chigozie Obioma grew up in Nigeria. He's a novelist, and he teaches at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and he agrees. Nigerians are definitely more optimistic, more hopeful.
Absolutely. You know, some time ago, somebody said to me, I think it was my dad's uncle, he said, here in Nigeria, everybody lives on a miracle. It's hard to generalize, of course, and stereotype people. But typically, there is a very strongly built-in belief or culture of hope in Nigeria and optimism. People believe generally that no matter what circumstance they are in right now, is going to turn around.
I think that would surprise so many people because we're talking about countries that, well, if you just walk around downtown Lagos, you'll see a lot of, if not actual misery, a lot of conditions
Absolutely,
for misery.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's what surprises me. So I've been an academic in America for the past 4 years, I'll say. Almost every semester, one or two very young students die.
By their own hand?
Yes, it's a very common thing. And I just keep wondering, okay, what drives this, given that, at least from an outside observer, life seems good for all of them. All my students have cars. And they're like 17, they're 18. You go to Nigeria, I was there just a month ago, and at least in the place where my parents live right now, maybe 2 out of 5 families have a car. You know, I mean, it's luxury. Their life seems good. They are U.S. citizens. They can wake up, take a passport and go anywhere. They at least have some money. They can make ends meet. So why do they lose hope so easily? So it was just what informed that.
So you took on this project. You went to Nigeria and you started interviewing people, asking them about hope, optimism, happiness. Tell me about that project.
Yeah. So I decided to go and investigate that happiness thing. You know, I would just walk around. Sometimes I'd take a taxi and just talk to people.
What were you asking them?
The first question was always, are you happy? The second would be something like, is this all you have? What is your job? What is it? Are you married? Something like that, just to try to pass out their economic standard. Then I asked them the ultimate question. In this condition where you find yourself now, have you ever considered ending your life? And most of them would just get mad at me.
Really?
Yes. They would be like, I mean, how could you even, are you not a Nigerian? Why would you think of something like that? That was the most common answer that they gave me.
So is it because suicide is just very, very frowned on? Or was it something more like, why would you even assume I'd ever be that unhappy?
For me, I think it really is just the African way of seeing life. There is something about the importance of existence and family. It also has to do with the support system. We have extended families. I call my cousins my brothers and sisters. I don't see them as cousins. So they, you know, so you're responsible not just for yourself, but for a whole clan of people. So I think that also has to do with that.
You know, there are African intellectuals who would say that that's not just about family structure, that that feeling of connection to other people
Yes.
is built into so many African philosophies in different parts of the country.
Absolutely. And so there's an ineffable feeling that I get whenever I'm in Nigeria that I don't get anywhere else. I'm not trying to idealize it. I hate a lot of things about it, like the poverty and all that and the politics. But there's something about the humanity of the people that strikes me as just unique in a way that is very difficult to grapple with. It might just have to be with the fact that There's just a lot of people who will come and try to be invested in your life. They ask you what an American might consider an invasive question. Just somebody who doesn't know you. And, you know, there's a freedom that I don't feel when I'm in the U.S. now and I meet a stranger, become somewhat self-conscious in a way that I almost never do when I'm in Nigeria.
I'm so happy to hear you say this because I was in Ethiopia recently in Addis, and, you know, like Lagos, a huge city, very conspicuous poverty, which was hard to see.
Yes.
And sitting on the plane coming back, I realized that I was so sad to be leaving. And I was trying to think, what is it that I feel that I'll miss so much? And it was hard to put my finger on it. It was something about the spirit or even the mood of the city.
You know what my mom said when she came here? Sadly, she has like only primary school education and can barely speak English. But she made an observation that I would not forget. She was like, is there like a curfew here? It's so quiet. There's no noise. Nobody's making, you know, any kind of sound. I'm like, this is welcome to America. You know, if your neighbor plays a loud music, that's like nuisance. You can even get the person arrested. But if you go to Lagos, the first thing that shocks you is the noise, is the animation, how alive, how loud, how insanely, you know, just like lively and boisterous and loquacious that 1,000 voices are speaking into your head at the same time. Mm. It feels more alive.
Yeah. People don't radiate as much friendliness here, I think. I don't know. Is that a huge stereotype?
No, it's not. You're very right. Though these days, because of the telephone culture, you see, you know, most people are probably always on their phone in Lagos, is one thing I observe. But yeah, growing up, that would be the same, especially in the marketplaces that is teeming with humanity and people.
Yeah. In the West, there's always been this terrible attitude post-colonization that the West has everything to teach Africa and Africa has everything to learn from the West. It sounds like what you're saying is, no, it's the reverse. Do you think people here could learn African optimism, or is it too late?
I think that there's a kind of a crisis here about that. I don't know exactly what they can learn from Africans, though, because being poor is not a virtue. It's not a good thing. Having a political system that is insanely corrupt is not a great thing either. But I also would wish that the sense of hope, that there's a student of mine whom I saw her from the moment she first came into my class 2 years ago, that she was going that way. She was always talking about how she's depressed and all that. And I took it upon myself to keep extra contact with her, give her books to read. I just would ask her, write a story, let me read it. Yeah, I'm trying to like make her see that she can be a great writer in future and make something out of herself. And I think that that has helped her a lot. She tends to be much, much hopeful, you know, wanting to have a future rather than just having this bleak perspective that, well, I'm going to probably someday die or something. So I hope that people can learn that. It is needful, I think.
Maybe we need Nigerian ambassadors of hope.
If you say so.
Chigozie Obioma's most recent novel is called An Orchestra of Minorities. He teaches at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. So as we're discovering, hope is a complicated, even slippery word. Maybe it demands a poet's voice. Here's Alice Walker.
Hope is a woman who has lost her fear. For Sundas Shekhar Saleh, Iraqi mother, with my love. In our despair that justice is slow, we sit with heads bowed, wondering how, even whether, we will ever be healed. Perhaps it is a question only the ravaged, the violated, seriously ask. And is that not now almost all of us? But hope is on the way. As usual, hope is a woman herding her children around her, all she retains of who she was. As usual, except for her kids, she has lost almost everything. Hope is a woman who has lost her fear, along with her home, her employment, her parents, her olive trees, her grapes, the peace of independence, the reassuring noises of ordinary neighbors. Hope rises. She always does. Did we fail to notice this in all the stories they've tried to suppress? Hope rises, and she puts on her same unfashionable threadbare cloak, and penniless she flings herself against the cold, polished, protective chainmail of the very powerful, the very rich. Chainmail that mimics suspiciously silver coins and lizard scales. And all she has to fight with is the reality of what was done to her country, her people, her children, her home. All she has is Alma, is what she has learned must never be done. Not in the name of war, and especially never in the name of peace. Hope is always the teacher with the toughest homework. Our assignment, to grasp what has never been breathed in our stolen empire on the hill. Without justice, we will never be healed.
Alice Walker, reading her poem, Hope is a Woman Who Has Lost Her Fear. Her latest book is called Taking the Arrow Out of the Heart, and that music was composed especially for the poem by Wendell Patrick. He's also a composer of original scores for the public radio show Out of the Blocks. Our special three-part series on hope will continue. And we'll get practical. Can you make hope? Here's the hip-hop artist, Common.
Optimism is not just only looking at what's in front of you and saying, man, and just determining from what you see in front of you that that's going to be the end result. That's not what optimism is or hope is. Hope has to do with also seeing things that may not be right there, tangible, right there in your face at the moment. Is having faith in the unseen. And I see a lot of hard times, but my hope and optimism also sees what's blossoming out of these hard times.
That's next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge.